Tonight's talk is on, as I mentioned, I'm right, you're wrong, end of discussion. And before I start the talk, because this is really on our views and clinging to views, I had a very normal incident, I guess. I was supposed to go out to California State Prison, Sacramento, early to meet with one of the... Pardon me?
You have a mic?
No.
If you could move your chair up to the front of the kitchen, I think that would help.
Okay.
That much closer.
All of this is being recorded. No, I can't sing. So, I'm going to go on an appointment, and then I'm meeting Dave Judd later at CSP SAC, and I go out to my car, and I have a Prius, an old Prius, 2004 Prius. I push the button to start it, nothing. Well, Rich and I had had a talk about batteries like last week, and when they die, you know, and what happens. And I went, oh, God, no, it's happened. You know, it's gone. And I couldn't get in. I had to take the key out of the fob because nothing was working, no electronics whatsoever. And as I'm doing this, I start thinking, my son used the car last. He was a very irresponsible person. And then I started thinking of all the things that he had done in the past, and a view started coming up, a view of he did it, how unfair, this is wrong, and I'm starting to get angry. I call AAA, and they come over, and they said, well, hopefully it's just the auxiliary battery, the little normal battery, and they started, and it was. And they said, well, somebody, and I don't know how they know this, they said someone left the dome light on and it drained the battery. Okay, how they knew that, I don't know, but that's what they said. And I said, oh, yeah, it was my son. And I started in, yeah, you know, unreliable, you know, didn't turn, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I called Dave and said, well, I will be out there. My car has started. And the whole time I'm thinking, boy, when I get home, I'm going to let him have it. But I also thought about this talk and clinging to a view. And I'm really glad sometimes, for many reasons, but that I get to teach because I get to really work with the topic. I don't just talk about it. I work with it a lot, and I work with view a lot, and I recognized I'm really clinging to this view. And what's going to happen when I get home? And as I started recognizing what I was doing, the view started dropping. You know, this is mindfulness, actually seeing how much suffering was in my own mind because I'm clinging to this view. Nothing can be done about this now. Why do it? So I got home that night, and I really nicely, in a nice tone of voice, said, well, my car didn't start because I guess when you drove it, you left the dome light on. And he said, when was that? And I gave him the date. He said, no, that was when you drove it. Remember? And he was right. I was the one who did it. And I was so glad. But what had happened if I kept that viewpoint and just went in and I wanted to stick with it so badly that I'm not going to back down. I'll find something else. I've got this viewpoint and it's mine. So that's what I want to talk about tonight. And I feel the need to go back to this right view, because it is so basic, and I think it's one of the most important things in this practice that we tend to forget. But it really is the practice itself. And especially nowadays, I don't know, well, I do know a lot of you, and you're doing the same thing I'm doing. Things come up in the news, and you immediately have a view. You don't even have to look at it or consider it. The view is there. And once you have that view, if there's another thing that happens, and it's kind of associated with that view, then you've got that view as well. Without any rational thought, it's just, that's my view. I'm doing that constantly, as not just politics, just anything that reinforces my, quote, progressive agenda. That's my view. And I really started seeing some of the fallacy of sticking to a view without really looking at the view itself. So, briefly, right view or wise view, the first of the Noble Eightfold Path, and then right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. It is said we start with right view, which is wanting to be on this path and wanting to work with all these elements, and if we diligently do it, we end up with a view that is truthful, unbiased, as clear as we can make it. So right view is mundane right view. When we're working through the path, we work through the path, we end up at what's called superior right view. And it's a view that is not cluttered. You have more clear comprehension on what is really taking place. Superior right view is said to be a complete understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And that is also considered an enlightened state, even though enlightenment, well, that's another, no, I'm not going there. But anyway, it's a place of non-suffering. So clinging to a view is grasping. And there's traditionally four types of clinging. Sense desires, and you've all had sense desires. If I just get this, everything will be fine. If I just get this car, I get this wife or husband or boyfriend or girlfriend, if I get this great meal, whatever, everything will be okay. But it isn't, because it stops. It's impermanent. And then you need the next thing. The Buddha said desire never satisfies desire. And after that type of clinging comes rites and rituals. And even we as clear-minded Buddhist people, how many people have we judged because they're not doing this practice? Or we think, boy, if they'd only do this, they'd be okay. They'd be more like me. That's a rite. That's a ritual. Thinking that you can change somebody else. And the third is this sense of self, thinking that this sense of self is permanent, that it's not going to change. And all you have to do is look at your bodies and look at your minds and how much you've changed. You can barely recognize the person, you know, 5, 10, 20, 30 years ago. And the last one, which is the one we'll be talking about, is clinging to views. Clinging to a view. So the summary of mundane right view might be called understanding karma. And that is just understanding for every action there is a reaction. And I think anybody can accept that. You don't have to be a Buddhist or a practitioner to see for every action there is a reaction. And you might not see it immediately, but it will take place at some point. And if you happen to believe in future lives, and certainly not everybody does, it could take place in a future life. So karma, our actions have consequences. And there's 10 unwholesome actions that we should do our best to avoid. And actually all of you know all of these. It sounds like another list, but it's actually just a compilation of three lists. So the first four are first four of the five precepts: not killing or harming living beings, not taking what is not freely given, not engaging in sexual misconduct, and speaking truthfully. The next three unskillful actions all have to deal with speech, and the Buddha put so much emphasis on speech. It's in so many lists. And here it's avoiding harsh speech, slander, and idle chatter. And then the last three are really just the three poisons. And they are covetedness. I can't even pronounce this, which is why I'm saying coveting. Covetedness. I think that's how you pronounce it. Hatred. And wrong view, which is ignorance. So these are the unwholesome actions which lead to unhappiness. And these are what we try to clarify as we're developing right or skillful view. Taken to its zenith, taken to the nth degree, I'm right, you're wrong, end of discussion. That's it. Nothing more need to be said because my view is absolutely cast in stone. Sometimes we might act like we're being conciliatory, but in our mind, we're not. Maybe to get along with somebody, we might act, I'm listening to you, but really, in between your ears, you're thinking, what a jerk. What a dumb point of view. And there's no nuance about it at all. Just, I know I'm right. And you're wrong. And our views are imprinted, and this isn't to blame us, they're imprinted on us from the day we are born. What culture we come from, where in the world we live, what sex we are or identify with, all of these things, what race we are, all contribute to our views. And we all just take them for granted that they're right. We don't even often, most of the time, even look at how we're responding to things because it's all built in from the day we were born. And maybe even personality has something to do with it as well. There's an interesting, as I was researching this, I wanted to ask you too, I always held the view for many years. I don't hold it anymore, but I thought maybe you guys might have some that you could share. And one of the views I always held was, if you play by the rules, everything will go all right. And I found out that's not true. And it was really why I came to this Buddhist practice, because I played by the rules and things didn't go right. And it was very hard to accept. And this practice gave me so much relief, just being with what's taking place now. No longer, why is this happening? Who knows why? But giving the mechanism to work with, you know, what is taking place? That's what I've gotten out of this practice. So, do you know what views you hold on to that you're not even aware of? As I'm saying this, do they occur to you what it might be? Think about it. What might be a view that you just absolutely take for granted, don't even consider it, but when you respond, it comes from that view? Yeah.
You know, I think the one that comes up for me that just sort of searches it. It's probably something like, everything should be the way I want it to be.
That's right.
And when I think about it, I think, you know, I don't think that really consciously, but I sort of base an awful lot of my actions and my reactions really on just, if it's the way I want it to be, it's good. If it's not the way I want it to be, it's not good.
Excellent. That's a great example, yeah, of clinging to a view. Yeah.
It's just totally I, me, and mine.
That's right. Yeah.
I have to underscore that. I try to, I've been in many different venues, government and art, and administration and everything, and politics, and there are the rules, and then there's the unwritten rules, and sometimes they don't agree with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that you don't always know the rules, but if you go back to, like you were talking about, finding what makes things work for you in whatever system you're at and allows you to be the kind of person you want to be, you don't have to even follow all the rules.
I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. That's interesting that that you brought that up. Yeah. Yes, Margaret?
The tip-off for me is when in my head I'm going, they should or I should.
Yes.
The other night I was on the way to a class and walking across the street, and a woman was driving up, came to a full stop, mind you, but she was talking on her cell phone. Mm-hmm. And she came to a full stop, but I didn't want to walk in front of her because she shouldn't be talking on the cell phone, mm-hmm. even though I was perfectly safe as a pedestrian. And I got half incensed, and she was going, "Why are you stopped for me?" But I noticed ever since then that as soon as the word "should" comes, then that's, mm-hmm. that's me coming into something,
yeah.
including chastising myself.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Let
Bob and then just.
Here's a Buddhist view that if you want to know what's true, you look at your own experience and your own evidence. I mean, that's a view because
mm-hmm.
maybe if you have a different tradition, you could say you look at a sacred text or you look at revelations that you intuitively get from God or something like that.
Exactly. It's a really difficult topic. This is why superior right view is huge, you know, to be able to work with all of that.
And I was just thinking of their car thing. I got a new car, and I said, "Okay, Mom, it comes with a horn, just so you know. You can use it when people do something wrong. It's okay." And when I was coming here, this guy cut the light, you know, it was red, and he went in front of me. And I thought, no, I'm doing it. So I went like this. And I was like, no. And he did it back at me. But it was a different thing. And I thought, I should have used my horn. I thought that was one of my... run away. That can hurt somebody. But I'm still going to keep thinking that. It's
right. Yeah, Rich.
There's just another version of you're playing by the rules and not necessarily having it turn out okay, but if I eat right and get plenty of exercise, my body will never fail me.
Yes. Absolutely. Yes. Why is this flab happening with everything I'm doing? Not fair. So this is also social psychological. Those of you who are therapists have probably heard of this. It's called confirmation bias, and it's about if we want it to be true. Kind of what Linda said. It must be true. I mean, we want it that way, so that's got to be true. And we look for examples to reify our belief. One of the examples I came up with is, say you have a friend, and that friend and you had an argument, and you haven't spoken for a while. So you call the friend, and you leave a message, and you say, "Give me a call back." And a week passes, and 2 weeks, and the friend doesn't call back. So you start thinking, what? What do you start thinking? Well, that jerk. I called, I tried to make amends, they're not calling me back. I can't believe what's happening. So to confirm your bias, you might go to somebody who you know doesn't like your friend and say, "Guess what? Guess what's happening?" And you look for confirmation for it. You look for evidence to sustain this belief. The friend might have never gotten the message. The friend might have changed their phone number. Who knows? You didn't bother finding any of that out. You wanted a confirmation of your beliefs. And so we look for that confirmation. And that's what we do in our own lives with our own views as well, just as I said at the beginning. If it's progressive, it must be good. You know, end of story. I'm not going anywhere else. Anger is another great example. I've talked about anger many times here. Anger is addicting. And if we're angry at someone, just like with the friend, we look for reasons to be angry. And if we can't find them, we'll make it up. We'll make up stories about why I should be angry. I've done that, and came up with it. I actually woke up, and I remember this specifically on a retreat, being angry at somebody and then coming up with scenarios, picturing this is what would take place, and that's what this person would do. Yeah, that's what would happen. And the anger's coming up, and I was on retreat, and I remember just going, what am I doing? None of this has happened. I have just made up this whole scenario, this whole other life, over nothing. And thank goodness for this practice, you know, where I did and didn't just keep going and take that back out into the world. We also tend to associate with people who share our worldview. How many people hang out with people who don't share your political leanings?
It's good practice.
It is excellent practice, absolutely. I totally, totally agree with you.
I think they're stupid.
Well, that's not the kind of practice I meant. A good example is marijuana. You know, a lot of people think marijuana is just awful. It's evil weed. If you're of a certain age, you really don't want it around, yet now they're finding out all kinds of medicinal uses for it and that it can be really helpful in many instances. I don't know if, not to get off on a tangent, which I tend to do, but in the Bee they did a story on this boy who had seizures, something like 60 times a day, I think it was. You heard about this guy?
Yeah, there was an elder.
Anyway, he was on all kinds of medications, trying everything. It was a feature story. It was in, I think, for about two or three editions. And his father, out of desperation, a friend of his said, I'll make up some marijuana without the hallucinogenic properties, but with the THC. We'll try it. You've tried everything else. And within a week, his seizures had stopped. Completely stopped. And he said he couldn't convince some people or his doctor that this worked, and this is before the legalization, because he also couldn't get a prescription, apparently. So he just went underground, you know, and kept using this. But this is a view. It's bad, no matter what. Doesn't matter if it worked, you know, for this child. It's bad, period. That's clinging to a view. And the most destructive view of all is, guess what it is? No guesses? It's the view of yourself. You cling to a view of yourself, thinking this is the way I am. And if you've got a really negative view of yourself, you're going to look for evidence, a confirmation bias, to solidify that. And that's how you're going to respond. Why would we do that? Because it's secure. Even though it is not happy and there's suffering, it's a secure self. And this is what the Buddha said we have to let go of, because there is no permanent self. This self-deception can be like a drug. It's addicting. You know, if you're a person that has low self-esteem, you will look for places and people who verify that. And your whole view will be only on people who verify they don't like me. I knew how people could be neutral, but you've decided, well, they're neutral because they don't like me. I knew nobody liked me. This could be, you know, so difficult to get over. And again, retreats really help unblock that kind of thinking. I was thinking about this, and I was wondering, why is that? Well, there's no one else to talk to but yourself. That's why. And so you have this conversation with yourself, and you start going, wait a minute, is that true? And as you start questioning it, and you're sitting there, and you can't get away from it, you start to stumble on some truths about yourself and your views. I have a relative. I actually do agree with you that I like talking to people who disagree with me, because I like practicing being kind. Even when I'm not feeling kind, I really like doing that. I think it's a good thing to try to do. And I have a relative who is very opposite of my political viewpoint. And when this whole healthcare thing took place, I truly wanted to know. He makes very little money, and you know, goes from job to job, and he's got healthcare for the first time in his life. And he was a supporter of this new healthcare plan. And I said, tell me why you support this healthcare plan. How do you benefit? And his answer was, all those liberals spend so much money. And I said, okay, but tell me why you don't support the health care plan you have. You can't trust any of them. This is how it went. And I realized I can't have a discussion with this person. It would be pointless. It would just go into a negative rant. And I would just start getting angry, and so it was pointless. So I dropped it. I hope I can find this. Okay. In this wonderful book by Bhikkhu Bodhi that I keep quoting, Social and Communal Harmony, and this particular statement is on settling disputes. And I love going to this and just looking, okay, what should I have done? What should I have done? What's the wise thing to do? And so he goes into someone like this particular relative. Now he's talking to his monks, and he says, then it may occur to you, monks, I shall be troubled, and the other person will be hurt. For the other person is given to anger and resentment, and he's firmly attached to his view, and he relinquishes with difficulty, and I cannot make that person emerge from the unwholesome and established and establish him in the wholesome. In that case, one should not underrate equanimity towards such a person. What a great piece of advice. Nothing to be done, but I can certainly wish him well. Hope that he'll be okay. That's it. But there's no point in having any kind of discussion with him either. I've talked to my son. Many of you know my son, Jared, who is a wildlife biologist up in Arcata. He's the spotted owl specialist for U.S. Forest Service. As I was telling Rich, probably out of a job very soon. But he's a great scientist, ornithologist. And he also has this wonderful sense of not sticking to a view. He actually looks at things from all viewpoints, which has gotten him into quite a bit of trouble. Arcata is an extremely progressive community. And he was telling us about, he was having a meeting with a lot of fellow scientists, and he vocalized a point of view that they didn't agree with. And he said they shut him down like that. Didn't want to hear it. He said up there, they call it virtue signaling. Has anybody ever heard of that? He said, oh yeah, you're not virtue signaling, you're cut off immediately. Virtue signaling, that's what, yeah, he said it's called. And he said, you have to signal what the people up there consider important virtues to be accepted. And he broke that rule.
He's a scientist. I'm a scientist too. I'm very curious to know, this is probably not the time to go into details, but afterward I'd like to know what it was he espoused, because he is a very sharp person. If he's a PhD from LSU, he really knows what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you talk science to people that don't want to hear it, their eyes glaze over, and you know in their body language to stop right then and there.
I will give you his email address, and you can ask him, because he told me, and it made no sense to me. I am not a scientist.
But the people up in Arcata and Humboldt got mad.
he said they cut him off immediately, and he started getting hate emails and Facebook posting that was...
Was it something about climate or something about the owl?
I think it was ornithological, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
So...
Give him his email.
Yeah, I'll give you his email so you can ask him exactly what was it. And another time, he and I were talking, and I made the statement, you know, I wish we were more like the Native Americans and you know, really upheld nature's rules better and, you know, appreciated nature better and, you know, nature's so wise. And he said to me, you have no idea how cruel nature is. And I was... really? And he went into some examples, and it was like burst my balloon, my view of, you know, if we'd all just sit around singing Kumbaya and, you know, kiss the earth, everything would be fine.
Well, in all the examples you've been giving, I've been noticing a lot of them are either about moral judgments, which could go either way, and you could have different feelings about people who exhibit certain behaviors, are there factually incorrect views about the world? But it always seemed to me that it's maybe not the content of the view, it's the clinging, the attachment, or the identification with the view. So if you could really believe in the Four Noble Truths, and if you're really weird about it and think that people who don't believe in the Four Noble Truths are really messed up and they're not worth talking. I mean, it seems like, I mean, could you kind of see, I mean, how do you do it, work with those distinctions between what's in that? Is it mostly the clinging and attachment to a view, mm-hmm. you think, rather mm-hmm. than the content of the view?
I think so, yeah. I've given a lot of talks on wrong view, and wrong view is clinging to a view. And I'm going to go into what you were just saying in a moment from something Ajahn Amaro has said, who I've been reading a lot of what he has to say on this. So in the Buddhist teachings, we try to see things as they are. And as you were saying, you know, get to as much truth as we can, which is not easy because of all the reasons that we've enumerated, from our culture to where we work to the people we hang around with to our own biases. It's really difficult. The Buddha said, actually, the commentary from Bhikkhu Bodhi says, the ideal attitude is threefold: to be open to receive correction from others, to be willing to correct offenders, and to make amends for one's offenses. So that kind of covers all of it. You know, if you're willing to do that, and I read someplace, the true test for self-knowledge is being able to admit you're wrong. I'm sorry, self-confidence is to be able to admit that you're wrong. So I started thinking, when have I admitted I've been wrong? Have you admitted when you've been wrong? Can you remember a time when you did that? When was it? When did you admit that you were wrong? And what did that feel like when you did that? Yeah, Terrell.
My grandson is, well, I think he's four now, but he's just afraid of everything. He's very fearful. And so and he has a little brother and bigger brother, and so they were watching a little cartoon video at my house, out in front of the house, and the little boy was going, I'm scared. And I said, it's not scary. And my son said, Mom, if he says he's scared, it is scary to him. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay. So I went in the house and thought about it, and I came back. I said, you're right. It's scary to him. I'm wrong. I'm sorry. And he's just like, oh, my God, my mother apologized.
I was just thinking that as I've gotten older, I've found it easier to admit being wrong, because I also bring forgiveness more easily. It's much easier to apologize at this point. And there seems to be some connection between those two gestures.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Barbara.
I found that clinging to views
when I can see it, it takes a lot of energy, and if I can identify in my mind, it's just a view to which I'm clinging, and I can let go of clinging to the view. I might still have the view, but it really, you know, I keep in mind the Buddhist statement, I do not contend with anyone. So then I don't have to argue about it because I'm not clinging to it. It's just a view.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the truth. It's not a the way the world is. It's just my view of it. And it's a lot easier to live in the world that way.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, Miles.
Yeah.
You decide.
Just backing up just a little bit when you talked about creating the scenarios in your mind. And that is really a view I cling to, whether it's called internet company or a credit card company or something. I've got it all rehearsed. It's going to give me a hard time. And I'm going to say this and that and the other thing. And then somebody slowly clocked me. I'm going to apologize to you.
Yeah.
So sorry. And I read somewhere, it was a quote, maybe Mark Twain, I paraphrased it, my life has been full of disasters, a few of which have actually happened.
Exactly. Exactly.
If I can remember to say this phrase that popped into my head a few years ago, just because I think it doesn't mean it's true.
That's right.
Really, really helpful. And then listening to you, I thought, and boy, do I have trouble doing that when I'm calling AT&T about it.
Yes. Yes. That's right. I've got a huge magnet on my refrigerator. Don't believe everything you think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's a good reminder, exactly what you're saying. So I brought these four little booklets. Actually, when I do my day-long retreat, I'm going to be using these. it's by Ajahn Amaro, and these are all on the contentious side of the Brahmaviharas. So he goes into especially clinging to view under metta, attachment. So on the day long, I'm coming in from that end as well because I learn so much when I screw up, way more than when things go well. And that's what he's talking about here. What happens when you're over-attached, when you just think this is the way it's got to be? What happens to you? How do you suffer? How do you get out of that? So he gives some really good advice in these books. And I'm going to quote something he said. Samaditti means right view. And he said, Sama doesn't mean that kind of rightness where I'm right. It means an upright way of being. It means being balanced. And he gives some helpful suggestions on taking truthiness. As Stephen Colbert said. So I'm going to read one section of what he says, and this is kind of along the lines of what Bob was saying, and he calls it attuned view. And whoever else said, views change according to circumstances. Right view also means attuned view, so to attuned attention, speech, etc., which tells a different story. Doing the right thing is not doing what is correct rather than what's incorrect. It's doing that which is righted, that which is in tune with the present moment. It is being attuned to the situation, to what is needed in any particular moment, what is beneficial for us and those we live with and for handling emotional conflicts, judgments, and opinions. This understanding of attunement is really the essence of metta, that loving kindness. The reason I wanted to bring that up, because he told a wonderful story, and I told it in my Brahmavihara class, so those of you who are in my class, forgive me for telling it, but I think it really goes into right view. And Ajahn Sumedho, who was one of Ajahn Chah's, the great Thai master's, first Western disciple, when he was a young monk in Thailand under Ajahn Chah, they would have periodic meetings where the monks could discuss what had happened, and if somebody did something that offended someone else, they could say it out loud and they could do their forgiveness and, you know, clear the air kind of thing. And they do this periodically. So Ajahn Sumedho went to this meeting. He'd only been a monk, I think, a year and a half or 2 years. And there was a Thai monk there who apparently spoke very coarsely. He spoke out of turn. He would berate people. And no one ever did anything. No one told him to stop. They just kind of accepted it. And Ajahn Sumedho was getting madder and madder about this. Every time he went to one of these meetings, he's going, why isn't anybody saying anything? And finally, he stood up and said, well, I've got a problem. That monk there, the way he talks and the way he berates and the way he acts, I think it's offensive, and I think he should stop it right now, and we should all complain as a community. And the monk looked very shamefaced and put his head down and walked out. And Ajahn Sumedho apparently felt he did a good thing, good, rid of that, no problem. And he went to see Ajahn Chah the next day, and I got the impression that he thought he would be congratulated for taking care of this errant monk. And Ajahn Chah said, so, how do you feel about what you did yesterday? And he said, good. And he said, you know, you were right in facts, but you were wrong in the Dharma. Meaning that was not the time or place to do that, even though it was right. His view might have been right, but he did not handle it well. Ajahn Amaro, in his book, a student asks him, so what would you have done? And he said, I think I would have waited and spoke to him alone, not embarrass him, because in Thailand, being embarrassed in public is huge. This monk apparently left the monastery. Ajahn Chah said it was the last monastery he was trying to make it, and now he's gone. Because you were right in facts, but you were wrong in the Dharma. So it also depends a lot about on listening to others as well. Ajahn Amaro goes into that quite a bit. When you start developing a view, actually listening to what's going on, withholding the view. I had last week an inmate who had not had a cellmate for 2 years due to realignment. He was very, very happy. No cellmate, you know, on those 10 by 6 foot cells or whatever the size they are. And he came to our Sangha and he was pretty upset. And he said, well, they gave me a cellmate. And we said, you know, Sangha asked him, so what about him? And he said, oh, he's a really nice guy. He's mellow. He lets me meditate. He's really quiet. He's really a good guy. He said, but I don't want it this way. I don't want him there. And so, fortunately, he has a very wise Sangha who made him see all the suffering is right between your ears. This guy is fine. Anybody else would be happy to have someone like this. A couple guys said, let's trade. I'll take him. And that just put it in perspective. It was his view that I shouldn't have to deal with this that was keeping him in a state of suffering. So, listening to others, watching what our own minds are doing, Ajahn Amaro said, for attunement, we also have to look at the five precepts in every situation. It's our best guide. Am I causing harm? Especially, am I causing harm in this situation? He has some meditation advice that I really like, and I'm going to actually do this at the day long. He has his students think of a contentious issue, an argument, something that really gets you riled up, and he wants you to think about it. Get into it again. Feel everything about it, the emotion, everything, and then start tracing it back. And in meditation, you might find all of this just came from a view. It didn't come from anything else. It might have just started with a look. So I'm going to work with guiding this because I think it'll be a really interesting thing to do. And I love come up with the most contentious, worst thing you can think of and work with that. That's a lot of good stuff. So what about social justice and social action? You know, does this mean we just don't do anything? And he also has something to say about that I want to read. A student asked him, how does an activist who wants justice and wants to fight for justice step back from the reptilian brain reactions into the response place, you know, skillful action? Answer, he says, well, mindfully, it's recognize the feeling, we need justice here. Now, where am I coming from in that attitude? Then we turn that reflective quality inwards and say, okay, this situation seems unfair and not right. Now, how am I holding that? Where is it in my heart? Where is the feeling coming from? Is it coming, and I think this is the most important thing, is it coming from a sense of wanting to benefit the other as well as myself, or is it coming for an urge to punish? What's there? What's here? We try to be as clear and honest as we can. If you feel that you want the other to suffer, you can't just switch that feeling off. That's the feeling that's arisen, and that's where it's coming from, but you don't trust it. It's there, but you don't trust it. You don't place a view on it. It's what's taking place. However, you can't just decide, from today onward, I'm not going to feel angry, or I'll stop being afraid. I've had it with fear. The one who does the deciding is not working for the same company as the one who's doing the fearing. The systems analyst is not in discussion with the Tyrannosaurus Rex. It's a different language. Instead, you acknowledge your reaction. I recognize that I want that person to suffer. That's what I'm feeling. Okay. And now I know what I need to do. So I think that's really important, especially today, to understand if we have a view. Are we just against something or are we for something that will benefit others? And I know that's the trap I was falling into. And to solidify my own political views, I would just go through the news looking for everything that verified everything I thought, just to solidify it even more. And was forgetting about justice when justice is really needed. Not for punishment, but for justice. So, again, back to what Terrell said about working with and having conversations with people that you don't agree with, I think is wonderful. I don't think I said it tonight. No, I might have just told Rich. Before I came here on BBC America, they had a short segment. Did anybody see it about the two legislators from Texas?
I saw the story. I didn't read it. The ones who had to share a car.
Yes, yes. And they filmed themselves. So two legislators from Texas, apparently there was a snowstorm going on there. They're supposed to be in Washington. I guess they're Texas state senators. And they couldn't get planes out, so they decided they'd rent a car and do the drive, 16 hours, to Washington, D.C. together. One is a right-wing Republican, the other is a left-wing Democrat, and they were going to spend all this time together. And so they got in the car and they decided to film themselves. A road trip. So they did, and they had all kinds of, they only showed a very short segment, obviously. I'm going to look for it to get more, but shared donuts together, told stories, talked about legislation, found out what they had in common. They were singing. They were singing road songs and just having this great time. And by the time they got to Washington, they had agreed on so many things where they had been miles apart. They were letting go of their views, and I'm a this and I'm a that. They actually were concerned about their constituents and the best thing to do for them. I wish we could do more of that, because the more we pull to one side and they pull to another side, it's just going to switch back and forth. Nothing is going to get accomplished. So I love the idea of speaking and getting to know people who don't agree with us, so they can know us as people and we can know them as people. Connie's met one of my very dear friends, and Robin did too. Been my friend for 40 years. She's an evangelical Christian. She is a right-wing Republican. And she's one of the dearest people I know. We talk all the time. And I know she cares, you know, about the same things I care about. She's just coming from a different angle on how to deal with things. But there's never been any contention at all, just a whole lot of love. And I think it's kind of like these guys in the car. You get to know somebody and you realize they're just people too with a view. You know, do we have to stick to this so vividly? Yeah.
Our views are born from so often the causes and conditions that mm-hmm. we sprouted from, and so it seems that, and certainly those causes and conditions which we look at so intensely in Buddhist practice, it just seems like it's a there needs to be room for, or we need to really open to the possibility of recognizing that those causes and conditions that have created that individual's perspective are so different from mine, and that and so ultimately, you know, we need to kind of find some compassion in there,
right.
Just what, because I would want that as well. We need to do that. It's sort of raising the humanity level.
Exactly.
You know, that's what we do here. That's why it calls to me to want to practice Buddhism, because it does raise the humanity levels to such a high degree.
Right. Yeah.
I think the practice of Buddhism really helped me. Climate change is a passion of mine, and doing something about it at a national level is also a passion. I didn't know what to do when I retired. Then I found that there's a group that is a bipartisan group that deals with liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans
mm-hmm.
in Congress. And they lobby in Washington, they lobby in the fall, they lobby in the spring. I'm going to Washington again this June. I went 2 years ago. And we are linked up with members of Congress. They can be our member, they can be a conservative, they can be a liberal. And it's really interesting. You get different points of view. You don't always get a lot of time with them. But you listen to them. You don't try to tell them, you have to think this way. You listen.
Right.
And you find out, just like these guys on the road trip did, these are human beings.
Right.
And there's another show on TV that's helpful. Van Jones has a show where he demystifies the Trump supporters. He's on CNN, and it's really good. He meets with Trump supporters. He has town hall meetings. And you see a lot of these people are not what you think they are. They're not what you think they are. They're fighting. They're scared. They have viewpoints. They're human beings. It's really good.
Thank you, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes.
I was wondering how I cling to an idea, and I try to meditate, and then I hear something on TV, and it affects my whole body, and I just stay in bed all day. all my security, and I believe it. You know, how I not believe it. It's kind of think, well, you know, this is just something I've heard. You know, this may not be true. But then I cling to the idea because it seems so true. Mm-hmm. And I try to practice, and I have all this fear come up. And then I feel I'm attached to fear. And how can I get not attached to fear? I have anxiety anyhow, so it makes it worse with all this fear going around. So I'm trying to figure out how not to get attached to all and not make it real when it seems so real.
Mm-hmm. You know, the only suggestion I can give you is by knowing that this is taking place is the first step. Knowing this isn't real, that this is something that's coming up, and that you are aware of it, using mindfulness and taking it into your body, noticing where it's taking place in your body and the suffering that's coming from it. And there's no reality to it. You just have to keep doing it over and over and over again until it finally sinks in. This is impermanent. This is suffering. All right. One more and then it's 9 o'clock.
Sidebar. I understand about your practicing Buddhism and how it can affect me in a positive way, but thinking about Sri Lanka and National Geographic and about the Tamils and Tongans, they are Hindu, and 10% of the population, and the majority are Sinhalese. They are
mm-hmm.
Buddhist,
right.
And they've just perpetuated incredible atrocities. Happened in Myanmar also.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's at.
That's right.
And I've always been mystified about Cambodia and the Khmer Rouge in a Buddhist country
mm-hmm.
Where that could happen.
Yeah. Sticking to views.
Well, they're mm-hmm. people.
All right, so it is 9 o'clock and we are going to go home and let's just do a final metta. May our practice here tonight be of benefit to all living beings. May they all be peaceful and happy, safe and protected, and at ease with their lives. May all of us here be at ease with our lives as well. And may the good intentions we had tonight with our practice and our discussion be taken out into the world for the cause of peace and harmony amongst all living beings. So thank you all for coming.